Tonight on Arena, No Time to Die, The Guilty and Freshman Year are the movies up for review, and David Bulger on his new show, Uncle Ray. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Yes, Thursday night is indeed movie night, and hardly surprising that No Time to Die is the first we'll be speaking about this evening. James Bond has left active service, but his piece is short-lived. Well, there'd be no film if his piece wasn't short-lived, would there? An old friend from the CIA turns up asking for help. The Guilty, starring Jake Gyllenhaal as a demoted police officer assigned to a call dispatch desk, who is conflicted when he receives an emergency phone call from a kidnapped woman. And Freshman Year, written, directed and directed by and starring 24-year-old Cooper Reif as an immature student awkwardly adjusting to college life. Michael Pope, Gemma Cray have been watching the three films for us. They're with me in studio this evening. And as I said, No Time to Die, Daniel Craig's last outing as 007. This starts, Gemma, with a kind of a bit of a prequel, if you like. It sets up the events of Spectre, which was the last Bond film. So just explain what happens at the very top.
Well, actually, yes. Yeah. So it sets up Spectre in the fact that there's a pre-flashback, a flashback, and then we're in present day. So for the pre-flashback, Madeline, who's Bond's current beau at the end of Spectre, she is an adolescent, and she watches her mother be killed in front of her by a kind of sinister, scarred assassin type played by Rami Malek, Safin. So she is... So then we leap forward in time to the very, very end of Spectre, where Bond and Madeline are on a very, very romantic honeymoon in southern Italy, and again in this beautiful village, in this ridiculously luxurious hotel. And they talk about secrets. They have very intimate moments. And then he goes to visit the grave of Vesper, his ex from the...
The Eva Green character.
Yes, the Eva Green character from the earlier films. And he's ambushed. So he subsequently thinks that Madeline has set him up. And then we begin the actual action of the film.
It takes a while for it to get going. But I suppose if you're anybody, you might have forgotten the action of the previous film. So that mightn't be a bad thing to give you some kind of context. Daniel Craig, lots of people have praised him for giving a realness, in fact, to 007. But there hasn't been a lot of humour along the way. Has it changed when we come to his presentation here, would you say, well, Michael?
I think he's so comfortable in the role now that he's better with the one-liners and kind of the quippy stuff. And he's definitely having more fun with it, especially when he comes up with... with Ana de Armas' character Paloma, that's kind of a CIA mission in the middle of the film. That's delightful. It's really, really fun. Probably the most fun part of the film. But he is the second best Bond ever after Sean Connery, and he did star in the best Bond film ever, Casino Royale, which is fantastic. And everything and if you'll pardon the pun, the spectre of that film still hangs over this, probably too much because we're back. We're still involved with Vesper and grieving her and all that. Yeah, he's funnier and he's got a lightness of touch and he's got a humanity to it. And he's also got that kind of brutal, crunching kind of physicality that he's always had since the start. But yeah, I mean, he's nowhere near as dour and as pathologically miserable as, say, Quantum of Solace or Spectre, which is. Just kind of, this film is better than Spectre, but there's a lightness to touch. So even though in the middle of this film, there's a very intense, the intensity between him and Madeline rears its head again, and it all becomes very, very serious, and it's all doe-eyed, kind of like, I love you, no, I love you
right,
more.
Right, yeah, it's there, but we've 3 hours of film here, so I suppose there are lots of moves in and out of it. Rami Malek is given the task of playing a Bond villain. Is there anything that can be done with a Bond villain to make it anything more than just a Bond villain?
It's very over the top, all this. And I do think this film suffers from Spider-Man 3 syndrome, which is just too many villains. And, at one point, the finger goes to M. There's Christopher Waltz's character from Spectre is back again and leading things from his cell in an MI6 prison. It's all... There's too much threat coming from too many different areas that you can't really focus on one, and it doesn't feel actually like there is a threat. You know, it's all too kind of separated, and I do think the film kind of lacks that cohesion throughout, even right. when it comes to the characters that are featured in it.
All right, well, let's have a listen to Rami Malek as the villain character here. Lucifer Safin is, I believe, how he refers to himself. And Daniel Craig playing the character of James Bond.
The thing that no one wants to admit is that most people want things to happen to them. We tell each other lies about the fight for free will and independence, but we don't really want that. We want to be told how to live and then die when we are not looking. People want oblivion, and a few of us are born to build it for them. So here I am, their invisible god, sneaking under their skin.
You know that history isn't kind to those who play God.
And you don't? We both eradicate people to make the world a better place. I just want to be a little tidier.
That's Rami Malek as Safin and Daniel Craig as Bond. Much has been made of the female characters and the role of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's in all of this, in bringing forward those female characters. Did she bring something big to this film, do you think?
Gemma? Found it hard to find her voice in it. There was a few bit characters that had great moments of humour, and I wondered, were they her? Like, there was a great bit where the Daniel Danick's character, the scientist, was being bullied in the workplace, and it was a really, really short moment, but it actually brought a lot of energy to the scene, and I can kind of see that as being her glib humour. Now, I don't know, there's four credits on that script, yeah. So I don't know what's there for her, but I do feel there's so many characters in it. We don't get to know any of them really well.
Yeah, because we get Lashana Lynch is in there, isn't she? Yeah. She becomes a double O.
There's been quite a lot of fanfare about that. Yeah. Know, she's a double O that, you know, double O. She's 007. I think that was actually in the poster.
Yeah, she is 007 just because he's retired, not for any other reason.
As an actor, her character's called Nomi. As an actor, she's very capable, but she's kind of just got kind of stock attitude and lame one-liners. There's not really much to try. Now, if that's Phoebe Waller-Bridge, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's not terrible dialogue, but it's just not that interesting.
And Ana de Armas in there, as you say as well, but you were saying that was one of the pieces of the film that worked for you. I spoke to the director, Cary Fukunaga, earlier in the week. What do you think? Has he brought something to the franchise, or has he just brought Daniel Craig along nicely to $25 million in his back pocket?
For me, it felt very old school, where I think we did get a sense of emotional growth and get an attachment to him in other films. And I didn't feel any warmth here. But I do think there was so much happening that you're hard to be taken on an emotional journey where, you know, you're following the logistics of how they get the MacGuffin to point B, you know, like, and I do think, I wonder, I would love to have seen the draft that Danny Boyle had been working on before he left for creative differences, because I wonder would it have been different, or maybe it wouldn't have been. But it kind of felt a little bit too plot heavy. You know, and you didn't get that same.
All right, and it's 3 hours now, and I'm aware that there's stuff that happens in this film that we just can't touch. Yep. But have we any idea? Obviously, we know Daniel Craig is no longer going to be James Bond. Have we any idea where the franchise is going to go now? Have they left it difficult for us to work out, Michael?
Despite after the end credits, it's saying James Bond will return, which it always is. That's not a spoiler. I have, for the first time, literally no idea where this franchise will go. I mean, I would say space, but it's already been to space. So I guess we have to go further out in the solar system. Quantum of Saturn or Mars Raker or something. I don't know. Right. It's a bold move for the franchise, you know, for that. And I think Cary Fukunaga is very good, and it's got scale, and that's not always apparent in a Bond movie. Like Quantum of Solace and particularly Spectre have scale and explosions and car chases, but they don't really feel that epic. He does a good job. This film feels huge.
Did it work at the 3 hours and stars?
3 out of 5.
Three out of five. Overall, Gemma, did it work for you on stars?
Very cinematic and beautiful. And I think that's where it saved it to 3 stars for me, because the length was a real killer. But it's a very visual thing. It's worth going to see in the cinema.
And looking forward to where the franchise might go now.
I'd suspect a reboot. I'd suspect, like, you know,
we were discussing this earlier on. Yeah. I wouldn't mind if the franchise went back to the 60s.
Oh, that would be great.
Of course, yeah. Daniel Craig was a kind of a reboot too, but so yeah. They have to reboot again. Well, let's see what happens in the meantime. Kind of middle of the road from both of you there, seems to be, with the two sets of three stars. Let's move on then to The Guilty, starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Kerry Fukunaga, of course, involved in True Detective, as is the screenplay, the original screenplay here. This is a remake, this film, The Guilty, of a Danish film by a screenplay with Nick Pizzolatto, who was also involved in True Detective. Joe Baylor, the Jake Gyllenhaal character, where are we when we first meet him?
He's incredibly surly and grumpy and highly strung, taking 9/11 calls because he's a subject of a very controversial investigation. So he's busted down to working in this kind of call centre and taking all these calls. So he's dealing with, like, drug overdoses and yuppies who've been robbed by sex workers and all this kind of stuff. So he's contemptuous of these citizens in distress. And he's got his partner, Rick, is on edge because he's lying to kind of save Joe's skin. And this is all happening tomorrow at his hearing, and we're at the end of his shift. So that's kind of the setup. And then Joe, who's incredibly apathetic to all these people, gets a call from a terrified woman called Emily. Now, she can barely speak. She's kind of talking hush cones, played by Riley Keough. She's in trouble. She can't say why.
Well, let's listen to her. Let's listen to her be in trouble, because that's what she's saying. She's telling him precisely in this call what's wrong, and he has to be very careful about how he speaks to her, because clearly she shouldn't even be on the phone.
Emily.
What?
Emily, act like you're comforting your child, okay?
No, Mommy's going to be home soon, okay, sweetie?
Tell her to go to bed.
It's bedtime, sweetie. I'm sorry.
There you go, come on. Yeah, good. Okay, just keep it up, we're on our way.
Just leave the light on, okay?
Come on, enough. No. Give me the phone right now.
She only wants to talk to you, Emily. Tell him that. She only wants to talk to you.
She only wants to talk to me. She doesn't want to talk to you, I'm sorry.
Emily, I need the color of the car, okay? When I say the right one, say it's fine. Red, blue, black, white.
It's fine.
White?
Yes.
Is it a car?
No.
Truck?
Man.
What? No, just yes or no. Just yes or no answers, Emily.
I'm sorry, I have to hang up.
Emily.
I have to hang up.
Emily, don't hang up, okay? Put the phone on the floor in your pocket. Anywhere that he can't see it, all right? Just keep it on so we can track you. And if you can't, just call me back. My name is Joe. I'll be waiting. Emily, do you hear me? I will be waiting. My name is... Fuck.
Jake Gyllenhaal as Joe there, trying to keep Emily, played by Riley Keough, on the line in that scene from The Guilty. As if that tension isn't enough, Gemma, LA isn't LA that he's in, isn't it? Yeah, it's on fire.
Yeah, so the whole of the action takes place from his perspective in the 911 operator room, which is very suspiciously high tech. I wonder is it actually, which is this gorgeous teal colour, and then it's offset against this massive, impressive visuals of the hills are on fire. So one of the reasons he's finding it hard to help this woman is because all the emergency services are dealing with the fallout of that as well as the usual stuff. So he is left as one man to sort that pretty intense situation.
Well, I haven't seen the Danish film. I can't imagine that the dramatic music is in there underneath the Danish film. I would imagine it's a much more low-key effort altogether. What is added to you? What kind of finesse, Hollywood finesse, has brought to it here, Michael?
What Gemma said is the fact that the LA is on fire. It's kind of very small additions, really. You know, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, he's dealing with asthma, you know, I guess that's related to the fire. Starts off with, like, this kind of tiresome Bible quote, and then it actually kind of screws the pooch at the end. It doesn't take it to the same dark place that the original Danish film did. It's more or less a straight Xerox, I find. I mean, apart from the fact that Jake Gyllenhaal's performance is more intense, you know, it's more tears and there's more kind of crying and screaming that, you know, as you would expect.
Is that the star vehicle aspect of it?
It is, and it's the kind of star vehicle that you can see why he wanted to remake it, because it is, he's in every scene, but he's also almost in every shot. So it's an incredibly intense thing for an American actor to want to do, you know. But it is more or less a straight remake. It you know, there's very little difference between the two, apart from that yeah. kind of, the first one is kind of subtle and subdued, the original is subtle and subdued, the remake is kind of
a little bit more flashy.
It's an Antoine Fuqua film, so it's flashy and it's.
But there's a lot of tension in here. Are we carried through? It's an hour and 30 minutes. It kind of sounds like quite tight and taut. Are we carried through with that tension, and are we satisfied by the time we get to the end of it, Gemma?
I was not bored even for a second of watching Jake Gyllenhaal carry this. Now, I personally felt that there was a deep amount of highly unbelievable twists or turns that I was quite sceptical about. But nonetheless, I'm following it. I'm engaged. They do a great job of drip feeding that information at these pivotal times where, you know, it throws you in a wrong direction, and then you just find out more information about Joe himself, about the situation that she's in, about what's happening in the world around them. And it's nice because it's very claustrophobic, and again it kind of mimics the time when it was shot in 2020 in the middle of COVID.
So there were all sorts of restrictions, and having one person in one set and another person on the phone made that an awful lot easier. It also reminded me of Phone Box, you know, the Colin Farrell, the film that Colin Farrell was in. It really had that kind of locker room aspect to it, where, you know, closed closet type of aspect to it.
Well, it's told in real time. So, you know, it's 90 minutes long and you're there with Joe Baylor for 90 minutes. I mean, by the time, it is intense, and I don't know how I would feel if I hadn't seen the original, because I found the original to be not a five-star classic, but it's a very competent film. And the thriller aspect maybe wasn't as interesting as I thought it was. And the same goes for this. But I will say that it does feel maybe like a really, really good episode of a prestige TV show rather than a movie,
which is
kind of fine, you know.
And it's on Netflix. It's on Netflix
tomorrow, yeah.
Stars from you?
3.5. I actually quite enjoyed it. You know,
3.5. Gemma?
Yeah, solid 3.5. It wouldn't be something you'd think about too much afterwards, but you'd enjoy it in the middle of it.
Yeah, a bit like fast food. Is what you're saying. Let's move on then to Freshman Year. Writer-director Cooper Reif presents a semi-autobiographical college rom-com about the awkwardness of finding yourself in a new place with new people, not really knowing how to handle your first year of college, basically, is what he's talking about here. But he's 24-year-old. He writes, he directs, and he stars in this.
Yeah, and it's a really Cinderella story of this youngster plucked out of nowhere. He tweeted a link at Jay Duplass, quite a well established director, and he was like,
in the indie world that this film is.
Yeah, and he had shot just a little YouTube video himself with his girlfriend at the time over 5 days in their liberal arts college in California. Sent him that link, and then Jay was on board. He became his mentor and helped him out get this across the line.
Thanks. So he got it across the line, and we listened to a clip that features Cooper, the writer and director and star here, as Alex, the young man who's finding it difficult in his first year in college, and Maggie, played by Dylan Galula. They meet up again. They've had a night out together, and things have happened that might happen when you're at college. But the following day, Maggie is not quite in the place that Alex wants her to be in.
I'm talking about like going to my room and like hanging out there instead of here.
Oh. Like to kiss and have sex? Is that what you were asking?
I guess so.
Do you even know my name?
What's your name?
I'm not gonna just tell you.
Why? I'll tell you my name.
I know your name. It's Maggie Hill. You've been my RA for like 6 months now.
Why are you making me feel bad?
Because you should feel bad.
Okay, well, I do feel bad. What's your name?
Get out of here.
Get out of here? That's a weird name.
It's Alex.
Okay, Alex. I'm sorry that I didn't know or ask.
Why? Don't be sorry.
I'm not. I do want you to come to my room, though.
There you go. Maggie, played by Dylan Galula, and Alex, played by Cooper Raif, who also writes and directs this film, Freshman Year. It's real indie fare, this, Michael. Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of is a rom-com. You know where it's going.
I think you can tell if the film is for you by that clip, really, the way the dialogue is kind of overlapping. I mean, the film opens with two kind of hungover students sitting around their dorm room, and they have this kind of overlapping dialogue. And I was really worried that we were going to be stuck in kind of mumblecore, indie, kind of like barely together, barely coherent teen drama stuff, because sometimes the Duplass brothers do kind of, that's their stock in trade. But it's quick enough, it becomes, you realise that this kid, Cooper Raif, 24 years of age, I think he is, he also edited the film and produced it. He's such a goofball. He's kind of got this kind of eager, glaring, vulnerable smile that kind of just draws you in, even though everyone around him is really horrible, really, really mean people. And you kind of straight away, you kind of see that he's missing his mother and his sister. And he's kind of got, he talks to this toy, this stuffed animal who talks back in subtitle form.
Yeah.
Without him in that role, in such command of the tone,
material
itself, I'd worry that this would be maybe unwatchable.
Yeah, and the mother, his mother and his young sister, lovely scenes where they're both trying to come to terms with the fact that he's not home every weekend and, you know, time to let go for both of them. But the real thing I thought here was the chemistry between the two leads.
Yeah, it's quite palpable. It sells it, because, I mean, there's a very, what is it, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset moment where they're wandering around for a good portion of that film.
Yeah, and it's a two-hander essentially, yeah.
And it's very earnest and very kind of simplistic dialogue, but it's quite vulnerable and truthful. Like, you believe that, you believe it in it. And you're sort of rooting for them again. There is a little bit of that nice guy arrogance in Alex as well that we do explore. And then I think Dylan's character is so hurt and defensive. Like, it's a lovely dynamic.
Yeah, and it's, I suppose if you've ever been a freshman, you kind of know the stuff that's going on here. Stars from you, Gemma?
I thought it was 4. I was very impressed.
4, deserved impressed. Michael?
Down to Cooper Raif, really, is 4 out of 5 for me as well.
Now we know what Mark Duplass saw in that little link that he got. Michael Pope and Gemma Cray speaking to us about No Time to Die, which is in cinemas at the moment. The Guilty is on Netflix from tomorrow, and Freshman Year is available on digital platforms. Fans of Cush Kim Dance Theatre may remember the extraordinary production Swimming With My Mother, a duet first performed by choreographer David Bulger and his mother Madge back in 2011. The show explored the mother-son bond and the skills passed between generations. Now David returns with a new piece called Uncle Ray that looks at father figures and one particularly glamorous Hollywood uncle. This time, it's a duet performed with dancer Don Rongonvilla. It opens at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary the next weekend during the Dublin Theatre Festival, and both David and Don are with me in studio this evening. It's very hard to talk about Uncle Ray in some ways, but I've seen a glimpse of you as Uncle Ray on the website. Shows you dancing with a wire coat hanger beside a black and white TV.
Yeah.
So maybe if we get a sense of why you're doing that, it'll give us a sense of the story you're telling.
It started out with I wanted to make a bookend piece to Swimming With My Mother for my father. Mm. And my father passed away like 26 years ago. He was quite young when he died, and it was a kind of a tragic time, you know, and because of Swimming With My Mother, I thought I have to do something about my father. And when I was thinking back about what it would be, my father had a great sense of humour, and he used to invent these mad inventions and things. But when I was thinking back of when I was growing up in the 70s, I just kept thinking of the TV and having a black and white rented Philips television set in the corner. And we always had a clothes hanger on the back of it for some reason, you know, well, to try and tune it in.
Get a signal.
Yeah. And, you know, you'd get the reception, and you'd get probably RT1 or HTV Wells is the other one we used to get, because we were on the East Coast, so we'd get, you know, Crossroads and all. But you get the coat hanger, you'd have to stand there still for ages if you managed to get a good reception for it. So part of that image, I thought, would be great fun to look back in that, through that memory, and that TV and the sense of the imagery from the TV comes back to us through that. And so that's, we started to explore that, and we do some nice magic with the TV, and there's lots of movement in it.
Yeah.
And that idea of connecting, you know, connecting with your past and connecting with your past through a black and white television set seemed perfectly part of theatre.
Yeah, and while obviously you could have your mother Madge with you in 2011 for the reasons you've just explained, you know, you had to go elsewhere of having your father represented on stage. Now, I don't know if that's how you consider what Don is doing, or is it something else that's involved in terms of Don? Because it's a duet between yourself and Don.
It is, yeah. It's, I mean, Don can tell you all about his wonderful side of things, but, you know, in the Uncle Ray story, you know, Ray Bulger, the scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz, although he made hundreds of films and, you know, danced his way into the hearts of millions of people, he was the rubber lab comic dancer that... that is my uncle.
Yeah. Well, that's, now just rewind a little bit there, because I wasn't quite ready to release that piece of information just yet. Well, so Uncle Ray was a big, we're not talking some kind of, he went over to Hollywood and he did a couple of bits and pieces.
No,
here and there.
He did extraordinary things, and he, like, just knowing a lot about him, he made a Broadway debut. He made hundreds of Broadway shows. He went to Hollywood. He obviously is very famous for The Scarecrow, but I think anything I'm researching about him, he was very thankful for that role. In fact, he was supposed to be play the Tin Man originally, which I can't see, just in the style of his dancing. Hmm. So I'm looking at that connection and the Bulger connection in that through my father, and obviously my father's passed away. But I thought the odyssey of The Wizard of Oz, that they go on, and Dorothy meets the Scarecrow for the first time. Their relationship is really quite beautiful in the film, and the odyssey that they all go on to get their brains and their heart and the courage, and Dorothy wanting to go back home and realizing that there's no place like home. It just felt like it was a really nice story.
Yeah.
But also looking at the idea of fatherhood and or fatherhood and fathers and sons relationships, so there is two performers in the show, and Don,
well, let's go to Don then and ask you a little bit, because I'm sure did you know who David's Uncle Ray was when you were coming to do the show, Don?
No, he just he just rang me and said, Don, I'm doing a show about Uncle Ray, and the first thing in my head is Ray Charles.
Yeah, that's right.
But like, you know, and then he introduced to me about he told me the story about
who about Uncle Ray was,
Uncle Ray, and the Wizard of Oz and things like that.
So, yeah. So you had that little bit of knowledge then, at least when you started to work on the piece. But what became, and what is more important, even as David has suggested to us here, Don, is it becomes about your own relationship with your father. So tell us a little bit about your dad, Romel Valdez.
Yes. My dad is a action movie star in the year from 1970s till the early 2000s. So his life is like, he's my hero, you know, and I was brought up in the film set. And later on, I became a dancer. I was born in the 80s, and then became a dancer in the 90s. So my whole life was being surrounded by celebrities back home in the Philippines. And he's a stuntman as well. And I love acrobatics. And in this, connected to the shows, and what's the connection is, it's leaving a continue the legacy of the relationship of your dads. Mm. And that's why there's a television, because through the movies, my dad's still alive. Well, sadly, my dad passed away this year. And you know what? It's a celebration of life.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, in David's case, we're talking such a distance from the death of your father, David. You've had time, I suppose, never easy to process the death of a parent. Obviously, you know, you're always going to miss them. But in your case, Don, it must be a much rawer type of pain or raw set of emotions at this point in time?
To be honest with you, because of this COVID restriction, I still didn't get a chance to went back home just to see the graveyard. So it's tough, but you know what? Family is here, and my wife and kid is here, and this show actually seeing the beauty of life, and through the ingenious creator here with David. So
there's an extraordinary bond between the two of us, I think, because of this, and knowing that we wanted to explore the grieving process. Mm. And actually in my own story, going back, when I went back to the photographs to look, you know, through the family archive, as it were, you know, I kind of realised that I'd in some way put my father's death on a pause, some kind of like the facing up to the grieving process, yeah. You know, and I found that really quite shocking in a way when I found that out, that I had done that. And it's funny with this piece that we do look into the grief, and obviously Don's grief is much newer, and there's so many stages of grief, and so we discuss it a lot. But there's wonderful, I think it's a beautiful moment in the show. It is a stunning moment in the show where we have some of the footage of Don's dad's stunts and films, and we were able to make a duet. So you've father and son dancing together on stage, and it's rather
I can imagine
wonderful.
Yeah, I can imagine that, as you say it, I can see why you might find it incredibly moving as you describe it. It is just that, but it struck me as you were saying you put your father's the grief around that on pause. I'll come back to you about maybe the why of that,
yeah.
But it in your case, Don, you have just as you've described to us, you had to do that because of the COVID situation in some ways, put it on pause. You couldn't travel home. You couldn't actually deal with things. So how has this process with David and working on the show, how has that maybe helped you at least think about pressing, you know, getting the pause button off?
Well, I don't know if there is a right answer, but yes, it's tough. At the same time, it's kind of helping. You know, like for me, like dad is still alive because there's no closure for me. So for me, because of the distance of Ireland and the Philippines, so for me, like right now, he's still alive. But and then connection with the show, and that give me a kind of what you call this? You're saying that to me. Kind of help, what's that right word? Anyway, I'll get back to that. But this show helps me to continue his legacy, even though he's gone. Mm. Uncle Ray helps my dad's legacy, which is I promised to him the last time I actually see him, 2019. I said, look, I want to be like you. I want to continue what you're doing, because he's retired. And he's so happy, and you know, so... In many ways, it's all connected.
Yeah. he certainly moves like him, and the stunts and the way we've kind of choreographed that scene is it's really nice to see the style of his father's movement, and then the style of Don's own movement, and where he's
see how they that. Come. Yeah, because often you see that not only in dancers, but obviously between parents and their children.
That's right.
You can see some gesture or some movement that the child makes you think that's. Yeah. His, her mother, or his or her
or
father.
Yeah, it's rather special.
So talk to me a little bit, David, about you said this thing about putting the grief around your own father's death on pause.
I think it was it was to do with a headstone being cleaned. At the family, we're all trying to get my father's headstone being cleaned. And I realised that I'd never been out to see the grave. I didn't go out there. I think it was, I mean, it was quite traumatic. His death was quite traumatic, and he died in the ICU in Vincent's, and we as a family were given a choice. He wasn't getting any better, and we were given a choice that they were going to just take away the life support. And what they didn't tell us was that when they did that, it wasn't going to be immediate. It was going to be. There was going to be a vigil, and we all took turns to go in, which is great that we could be there. And you know, the hearing is said that hearing is the last thing to go. So we were said, when you're talking to your dad, make sure it's conversational. Make sure you know talk about. And I did, like I went in and I spoke about the old times, and you know spoke about all the things that he had done, the mad things. And he wasn't able to answer me, but you know there was that moment, and that I think. After that, I I just kind of blocked it out. I couldn't even go to the graveyard. Yeah. But now I feel really open about it, and I feel...
Well, the show must have given you a big chunk of that. Let me just finish by asking you, Don, do you know when you might get back and when you might get a chance to visit your father's grave? Because that would be such an important part of the process.
Oh, yeah, well... it's in the bucket list. Now, I hope that next year that I'm able to go home and see his graveyard.
But in the meantime, you can dance with him via the technology of the telly and you on a nightly basis.
And here's the beauty of this dance. And, you know, it's not like, I know we're talking about grief, but Uncle Ray's show is fun and it's funny and it's laugh. And you will laugh.
Very funny.
Trust me. Trust us when we say you laugh. You know?
Well, the best shows you laugh and cry. So I'm guessing I'll probably do both. Yeah. That's Uncle Ray, David Bulger, speaking to us about it this evening along with Don Roncalvilla. The two performers in Uncle Ray, which is at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary from the 7th through until the 9th of October. And subsequently, it's at the Belfast International Arts Festival on the 13th and 14th of October. You can find out full details on cushcane.com. This week is Travellers Pride Week, with events taking place all over the country. One of the projects that caught our eye is from the Kerry Travellers Health and Community Development Project. Roads Well Travelled is a film made by Mort Mulcahy. It's a series of interviews with travellers recalling their lives on the road. Puck Fair in Killorgan is a big gathering for travellers. And this is Teresa O'Brien describing her appearance of the fair back in her early married life.
Hired out this field off of George Evans.
Right.
We paid him so much a caravan. I think it was a half a crown each for each caravan, but there was loads of them. All the field was full. We'd our caravan there, our wagon there, our own barrel top wagon. We'd it there. And we went up to Polk.
Did you walk out here from Polk?
We did. So we just walk everywhere.
Well, where would the trailers be now?
Wagons, all wagons, all everywhere. Wagon. George Evans owned it, this field, the man in that farmer's house there. And you'd pay him so much a wagon that all have fires lighting and that have tables outside, like, and things like that. And it was lovely, everyone had enjoyed. The men would go up around the horses and the women would go up walking after with the children.
Teresa O'Brien there. The filmmaker Mort Mulcahy also spoke to Charlie Doherty about losing his wife and his love on the road.
We got settled down and we bought a caravan. We came back to Kerry and we settled down the ladies' walk, right two across, and I bought a pony, I bought a caravan, and I pulled aside the road, and we were travelling here and there, and we were swapping in there and going to the horse fair, Academy, Spencer Hill, and the store fair, the horse fair and the store. And we travelled back around Kerry, and we met all the travellers, and we used to pull in and out, and we used to get on together, and there'd be no drinking, only our cracks and jokes. Women in one fire and the men in another fire talk about horses and about wagons, about this thing and about that thing. I used to be out the country collecting a bit of scrap and a farthing and maybe clothes. I got to know the people got to know me. We got settled down. I prayed for a house and I waited for a house and I got the house. And my wife didn't get sick. She died in Cork. She died with a heart complaint. And she's a young woman and they couldn't do nothing for her. So I have no pony car at the moment, but I will get a pony car later on for the summer and I can do my business myself. Because I just put up at the house myself when I'm stuck in the house. I'd rather be out the country talking to you and to him and get on with their neighbours and everything be all right.
Charlie Doherty. Katie Coffey, meanwhile, talks about the differences between herself and the younger generation when it comes to going on the road.
About 10 or 11 years ago, we stopped travelling. What we does now is we goes away for the weekend, and it's not the same, like, but we goes away now, me and my sister camping ourselves, but all our younger lads, they goes away for the weekend, they goes to hotels and holidays and all that now, but I wouldn't like that. I'd rather the old way. I'd rather give the children, our children now, a taste of what it's like to sit around an open fire without the forms. And there's so many options they have now. The children... You'd hardly see the children out playing, all the forms and things like that. We left the forms behind us when we were going away. When we were taking our grandnieces and grandnephews away. We locks the form into the house or wherever they are, and we'll bring them away without it, because that's how you get to know them, and that's how they get to know you, and you can be telling them stories going along, bake a cake of bread. We still have the cover and oven that my mother used to bake a cake of bread in, and she used to make apple tarts in it, and God, it was lovely. And the tongues, we'd have the tongues. It would take hours now to bake a cake of bread, and just like you'd eat it when you it's cooked, because it would take so long, but you couldn't taste nicer.
Oh, I'm sure you couldn't, Katie. That's Katie Coffey there, ending our extracts from Roads Well Travelled by Mert Mulcahy, a film featuring men and women from the Kerry Travellers Health and Community Development Project as part of this year's Travellers Pride Week. The Peabod Award-winning filmmaker Vivian Clyman tells the story of the queer comic book scene in her latest documentary, No Straight Lines, The Rise of Queer Comics. The film documents queer comic books from their marginalised underground origins right up to the mainstream acceptance. Focuses on five key artists, including Rupert Kinnard and Alison Bechdel, who described the eureka moments they experienced when they really examined what it was they wanted to say and, crucially, who they wanted to represent in their work. No Straight Lines will be the closing film for this year's Gaze International LGBTQ Plus Film Festival, which is on in Dublin at the moment. It will be screened this Sunday at the Lighthouse Cinema. And I'm delighted to be joined by Vivian Clyman from California this evening. Vivian, under normal circumstances, you would have travelled over for this screening. You have attended Gaze festivals in previous years. You're disappointed not to be here, I'm guessing.
I'm completely heartbroken. You know, I was so fortunate to attend the festival 2 years ago, and I was so impressed with the joy and intelligence and sophisticated programming that the Gaze Festival offers. Mm-hmm. So I am delighted, however, that it is going on and that people will get a chance to see my work.
I'm guessing you must have been making this film or certainly in the maybe the post-production stages of making this film when you were here last time. But let's get a sense of what it was attracted you to the topic of queer comic books for a documentary, Vivian.
Well, you know, unlike straight comics, which are largely about superheroes, queer comics are focused more about representing ourselves, our lives. And, you know, coming out myself, I turned to Alison Bechdel's work for a lot of inspiration and an enormous amount of humor in her series, Dykes to Watch Out For. But I wasn't planning on doing a film on the subject. I was approached by a colleague, Greg Sirota, and his friend, Justin Hall, who is an expert in the subject matter. And the two of them encouraged me to attend the world's first ingathering of queer comic book artists. And as you guessed, that was several years back. That was in 2015 in New York City. And oh my God, I walked into the conference hall and I was stunned by what I saw. You know, contrary to the stereotype that I had of the grumpy artists, this was a room filled with a huge range of queer people, from the young woman in chartreuse colored hair to the older Southern gentleman with a button-down collared shirt. And oh, by the way, they were both surrounded by gender nonconforming and trans artists, and they're all taking delight in one another. And over the course of the few days of the conference, I heard stories of how they were grappling with the entire range of issues of the day, those that are specific to, you know, queer lives, like coming out and the fear of parental rejection, to, you know, feelings that are shared by a lot of people looking for love, or at least trying to.
let's listen to get a sense of some of those artists who featured in the documentary and who tell us about about their early experiences. I was really struck by Mary Wings, who I suppose was a real pioneer in terms of her comic book writing. She's the artist behind Come Out Comics, and she describes in this clip her disappointment the first time she read a strip called Sandy Comes Out and the gay characters that she was reading about in that strip.
It looked very superficial to me. It's sort of as if one day she wakes up, she takes a karate class, she sleeps with a woman, men can't come into her house, she's going to wear overalls forever and never shave her armpits goodbye the end. And I thought, well, this has nothing to do with what it really feels like. And I didn't know what I was doing. I grabbed a rapidograph pen and I sat on a sofa with bad lighting and I just sort of went at it. Come On Comics is a very simple story about a woman who gets attracted to another woman and, oh dear, what are they going to do about it and do they really feel that way? I really wanted to do something that showed all the emotion, all the sort of worry and trauma that you have about coming out and all those things about really being a queer.
And that's Mary Wings speaking in Vivian Kleiman's new documentary, No Straight Lines. And we should point out, it is also she who is playing the accordion in that clip as well. Or at least that's what it looks like in the film. Vivian, Mary speaks there about, you know, how disappointed she was in what she saw. How difficult was it in those initial years? I suppose we're talking kind of around the 60s, really, when things started to open up a little bit. How difficult was it for a gay comic book writer to even be seen?
Well, that's a really good question. And by the way, I love the clip that you just played. Everybody laughs at that notion of, you know, not stopping shaving under the underarmpits. You know, it was as it's quite commonly noted how threatening it was to come out, period, let alone coming out as an artist, if one has been a professional artist, as Mary was, as Howard Cruz and others. And so these folks really jeopardized their careers, their families, their relationships, and, you know, they virtually had no role models to turn to. So they were true pioneers in every sense of the word.
Yeah, and Howard Cruz should be mentioned as well. He died subsequent to the completion of the film, and I know that there's a dedication to him at the end of the film that I found quite moving just to see that there. But later on, we hear, I suppose, not from a slightly younger generation in Alison Bechdel, Jennifer Camper and Rupert Kinnard. I think it's Jennifer who speaks about, you know, we could do what we wanted because essentially people didn't care. Nobody was reading us except the community that we were speaking directly to.
Correct. And that's one of the beauties of the start of this entire genre, that there was no expectation of monetary gain. And when you leech that component from the creative process, my goodness, you've opened up one's heart and anything is possible.
Rupert Kinnard, and a fascinating story across the span of the film itself, but I'm just going to go to the first part of his story, which is where he tells us about how he came up with the idea for his Brown Bomber and a character called Superbad. Fascinating story here, Rupert Kinnard.
I grew up in Chicago, and my hero in popular culture was Muhammad Ali.
Cassius Clay of Chicago challenges Gary Joyce.
Muhammad Ali didn't merely say he was the greatest. He said, I am so pretty.
He's too ugly to be the world's champ. The world's champ should be pretty like me.
Well, the degree to which white people hated his brashness increased my love for him. One of the things that struck me was his confidence during a period of time where black men were almost like not wanting to be seen, you know, being literally the invisible man. Once I started becoming really enamored of Muhammad Ali and his message, it was like a wake-up call. I looked at these characters I was drawing and I thought, my God, why the hell am I drawing white superheroes? And there was a certain degree of anger. The word that keeps coming to mind, oddly enough, is bamboozled. I felt that I had accepted that the world of comics were white, and that led me to create Superbad.
Superbad and the Brown Bomber, the creations of Rupert Kinnard. And there he is speaking from the documentary No Straight Lines, director Vivian Kleiman speaking with me this evening. The rise of the graphic novel in the 70s, I guess, was very important. Is that part of, Vivian, do you think, what brought particularly gay comic book culture into the mainstream?
Well, that's a very interesting question. You know, I think it took much longer than that. I think it wasn't until Alison Bechdel's
yeah.
Enormous success of Fun Home, the first queer graphic novel, and it was a New York Times bestseller for many, many weeks, like 50 weeks, something like that. I think it took several decades. Mm. It took until 2006, actually,
for
mainstream acceptance of queer comics. Yeah,
yeah. And Fun Home.
And it's very, very unusual for me to identify a year, but I think we actually
can be free
to say that.
Fun Home, of course, was also a Broadway musical, which again brings it into a different kind of mainstream position as well. Do you think, Vivian, is it possible to quantify the impact of the queer comic book scene, particularly in America, on the perception and representation of the queer community there?
That's always a very difficult question in terms of quantifying. But I guess if we were to speak about numbers of sales, then that would be it, and we'd say bingo. it's been huge. And I would also have to say that the notion of using the contemporary technology of the internet and the rise of web comics and the plethora of new young artists who have emerged in all the different styles, from sci-fi and horror to more documentary kind of work, is testament to the impact wide and far. And I think that it's the comics themselves that are both impacting general society and perceptions of queer life and comics, but it also operates in the reverse.
Well, listen, Vivian, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for joining us. Probably morning time with you over there. Thanks for being with us on the programme this evening. Vivian Kleiman there, No Straight Lines. It closes, the film she's been speaking to us about, closes the Gays International LGBTQ Plus Film Festival on Sunday, 3rd of October at the Lighthouse Cinema. Gays is running currently screenings at the IFI Cinema at the Lighthouse and online on IFI at Home. More information on Gays, G-A-Z-E. IE. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.